Well, I want to invite you this morning to take your moment, and we want to look at the book of Hebrews. We started a couple weeks ago through this season of Lent leading up to Easter, looking through the book of Hebrews at the theme of the Hebrews, and that simply is that Jesus is better. He's bigger, he's greater, he's stronger. Christ is superior to any obstacle or anything else that might vie for our affections or attention or worship. He is better. Now, why is he better? So I want you to take your outline, that worship bulletin you've got this morning, and maybe just take a few notes and follow along with me. But let me just remind you of why Jesus is better. You can write it there. Jesus is better because of who he is and what he has done. And that really just tells us how Hebrews is laid out. The first part of the book deals with who Jesus really is. We look at the person of Jesus Christ. And then what he has done, the work of Jesus Christ. And because of who he is and what he has done, we see what Hebrews is all about. And ultimately, Jesus is better. So just a little bit of a reminder, if you're starting new with us this morning, the book of Hebrews was written by an unknown author, but we consider him to be sort of maybe a pastor, or just referring to him as the preacher. He's writing to a small congregation of Jewish believers that have left Judaism to follow Christ, probably maybe in Rome, but they're being persecuted. They're facing trials. They're struggling because of their Christian faith and following Jesus, and they're tempted to go back to their life of Judaism, not knowing or forgetting that Jesus is much better than that. And so this book is really like a sermon. It's a sermon that is written for this preacher to inspire, to encourage this group of believers, this church that's struggling to endure, to end their faith. They were faltering spiritually. And so he's encouraging them to persevere to the end. Don't quit and don't give up. Don't go back. Why? Well, because Jesus is better. Jesus is better than whatever you're facing. So all through the book of Hebrews, the preacher talking about why Jesus is better, who he is, what he's done. But then he sprinkles through there five significant passages we call warning passages. And so these are like red lights that are going off. Warning, warning, warning. There's danger ahead. And so he is giving them some warnings. Last Sunday, we saw the first warning that came up. It's the first great spiritual danger that he wants them to be aware of. And it's the greatest spiritual danger I think all of us as believers who call ourselves followers of Christ face. And that is the spiritual danger of drifting away. So we're becoming untied from the anchor of Christ, who is the hope of our soul, losing our moorings and sort of being caught up in the currents and sort of drifting away. And so that's what he talks about in the first verses of chapter 2. He says, we must pay most careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. Then he gets down to verse 3 and says, how shall we escape if we ignore or neglect so great a salvation? And so he says, pay attention. Pay attention to what you've heard. Don't neglect this salvation, this great salvation that you have. Otherwise, you'll drift away and how you escape. And really what I think he's talking about there is the great danger of drifting. And you know what the danger of drifting is? You will always miss your destination. Drifting never takes you to the ultimate destination. And so that's what he's warning them about. Don't miss your destination. The spiritual destination for believers, we know, ultimately is eternal life, our home in heaven. And so he's warning them, don't drift. It's dangerous. You could end up missing your destination. So don't neglect your salvation. Really what he's telling them is it's important to begin your life with Jesus Christ. It's very important how you begin. and begin to become a Christian. But then it goes on to say, not only do you begin as a Christian, but you are being a Christian. And you're living out your Christian faith. As you become a Christian, you are being a Christian. Then ultimately talks to them about what happens in the end of that, that you cross the finish line. So he says it's important to find Jesus. It's important to follow Jesus. It's important to finish with Jesus. And he's encouraging them to be faithful to the finish. So let me just remind you quickly, and this is probably one of the great images I have of Jesus Christ. I encourage you to think about that Jesus is your hero. And you think about him as this champion. That's what he talks about in verse 10. He is the pioneer of our faith. He trailblazes. He makes the way. He goes on ahead of us and prepares the way for us to make it to heaven. He's our hero. He's our champion. He's so much better than the angels. And he makes us part of his family. So he says in verse 11 that he is not ashamed or embarrassed to call you and me brothers and sisters. And so he's not embarrassed of us. He's not ashamed of us. In other words, can I say it this way? He is proud of his church. He is proud of you and me because of what he has done for us and the gift that we received through him. And so he sets us free then, once we're part of his family, from this fear of death. We don't have to fear the enemy of the devil. We're just free from that fear of death that would hold us. And then he says at the end of chapter 2, he is our great high priest who helps us. And all through the book of Hebrews, this is a theme that the writer picks upon. It is the high priest that Jesus fulfills that role for us. But I want you to go to chapter 3 this morning. And as you look at Hebrews chapter 3, we're going to find a second warning passage that is there. And it's a few verses before he gets there. And I just want to take you quickly through those first 6 verses. But we'll get to that second warning passage. It really begins to unfold in verse 7. But this is so important. I want you to really grab a hold of what he says here. I think this is one of the single greatest sentences in all of the Bible that talks about the church. And so he says in verse 1, therefore, because Christ is better and superior, Jesus is better, he's our champion, he's our hero, he's our high priest, he sets us free, because he helps us, he gives us this hope, because of all those things, therefore, holy brothers and sisters, we share in the heavenly calling. Therefore, holy brothers and sisters, those of us who share in this heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus. Fix your thoughts on Jesus, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and our high priest. And then he picks up on it again. So high priest is used several times in the book of Hebrews. This is the only place in all of the New Testament Jesus is called an apostle. Literally, apostle just means a sent one. And so Jesus is an apostle in the sense that he comes sent from God the Father from heaven with the message and the method of the good news of the gospel. He comes as the sent one. So let me tell you just real quickly, and it deserves much more attention than we can give it this morning, but just a couple of 3 things of what he says in just that one single sentence in that verse. And this is what he's saying to the church. Now remember, he's writing to a group of believers, the church. They're possibly in Rome in that area, faltering, struggling in their faith. He just says to them, therefore, holy brothers and sisters. Now, notice, first of all, what he calls them. He calls them brothers and sisters. Literally, just one word that's used. It's brethren, but it alludes to brothers and sisters. And it kind of, to me, it harkens back to at least an older day in the church and in our tradition, other traditions. It was quite common for Christians to call each other brothers and sisters. You know, Brother Randy and Sister Donnell and That's how I grew up in the church that did that a lot. And it wasn't, we'd often do it for the pastor and his wife. It was applicable to everybody who was a believer. We were brothers and sisters in the church because the church is now family. So now he's using a term that refers to the family, the community of believers that are much different. In a sense, this analogy of the family is really my favorite analogy of the church. And so we are a family solely on the basis of our faith in Jesus Christ. It is literally the only thing that we have in common across the board that holds all of us together. We're not related by blood. There may be some things about us that are ethnically different, racially different, maybe, you know, a lot of different things that interest, affinities. You know, the church is really a collection of a bunch of people that lots of us don't have really anything in common. And outside of the church, we'd probably not even have a relationship. We might not even be friends. But in the church, well, we're not just friends. We're family. We're brothers and sisters. Because of what has happened to us, what Christ has done for us, because he's not ashamed of us, he made us brothers and sisters. It's different. We have this common experience of salvation and this common mission that holds us together. The church is not like any other club or voluntary organization. The church is not a voluntary organization where people get together based on some common interest. They commit themselves together. They're like-minded people. But when you get to the church, it includes people that we would never dream of. We'd never dream of hanging out with them. We'd never dream of working together with them if we weren't family, if we weren't brothers and sisters. And so, you know, when you quit a voluntary organization, a society or club or group that you're a part of, you sort of just quit paying your dues, or you just drop out and you quit going. The only way that a believer can leave the church is you just walk out on your family. You just quit the family. You leave home. Now, the second thing he says, now, you're not just brothers and sisters, but you're holy. Holy brothers and sisters. And people sort of freak out at this word holy. And, you know, a long time we commonly use it, we talk about the Bible being the Holy Bible, which literally means it's just a holy book. But it's holy in the sense that it is set apart, it's dedicated for a particular purpose, and that's really what holy means. So when we say that we are holy brothers and sisters, we're not even beginning to refer that we are somehow morally or spiritually superior or better than others. We're not, by the way. We're just a group of messed up, screwed up, sinful people that still do a lot of dumb things, sometimes a lot of sinful things. But we're still part of that church. So we're not holy because of what we do or because we are somehow better or superior. We are holy in the sense that we are set apart, that we are dedicated. And holy just means that something ordinary now has been set apart for an extraordinary purpose. Let me give you this example for those of us who are believers. You know, when we celebrate the Lord's Supper or communion, we pass out the bread and we take that little piece of bread. That is just a very ordinary, common piece of bread. Matter of fact, it's not even a good piece of bread. You know, it's just an ordinary piece of bread. But once it is now in the communion, it is holy in the sense, not because it's better, it is just set aside to be a reminder. It has a purpose. It is to remind us now of the body of Christ. In that sense, it is holy. So now we're part of the family. we are holy because what Christ has done for us. But then he goes on to say one more thing. He says, now holy brothers and sisters who share, and some of your translations may say, an older translation, say partakers. Some translations will use the word partner, that we come together, we share together in this heavenly calling. Now he's talking about the very purpose for why we exist, who we are as the church. And so this is a heavenly calling that comes first of all down from heaven, calling us, and then it is calling us then to take this calling and to make our way back to heaven and to tell others how to get there with us. In other words, we have a heavenly calling. We have this mission. And this is what I always need to be reminded of myself as a pastor. It doesn't matter how big your church is. It doesn't matter how well-known your church is. It doesn't matter how influential your church is. It doesn't matter how much money your church has. It doesn't matter. As a church, all we have going for us is Jesus. That's all we got. There is no other reason for us to exist. We don't even make a good social club half the time. You know, we can do a few good things, but we can't, you know, we can help some people who are suffering or poor, and we can do a pretty good job at that. But there are others that could do even a better job than that. Because that's not ultimately what we're called to do. We have a heavenly calling. All we have going for us is Jesus. We have a mission. And that mission is to make Jesus known. And so he says now, all right, your family set apart with this mission. And so troubles come, and there'll be nothing that will cause us to falter, to waver, to drift in our faith than when hardships come. And so now he says to this struggling group of believers, fix your thoughts on Jesus. And this word is it's a powerful word. It means to you have this desire. You want to know all you can know about Jesus. And so you concentrate on Jesus. I mean, you just focus like a laser on Jesus. This takes discipline. This takes effort. This takes time. And you focus on Jesus. Every spare thought, every spare moment, you learn all that you can thinking about Jesus. He's this apostle. He is this one sent from heaven. He is the high priest. And all of that holds us together. Then he says, on the basis, what he says there, on this basis of what we profess. And so you get down, read a little bit further. He is a faithful one who appointed them. He's a high priest that calls us. And that acknowledgement, that profession, that's that confession that Jesus is Lord. Now let me take you down. Now what he says here in these next couple, three, four verses is that Jesus not only is better than the angels, he is better than, and for Jews, I mean, they've got to get a hold of this. He's better than Moses. Wow. Better than Moses. Nobody's better than Moses in the eyes of a Jew. Moses. Why, Moses is the greatest leader that ever lived. He's the greatest person that ever lived for a Jew. You know, so to say that Jesus is better than Moses, he's reminding the fact, yes, he's better than Moses. He has been faithful, not as a servant, but as a son. Then he says in verse 6, but Christ is faithful as a son over God's house. And we are his house. We're the spiritual home and house of Jesus. And then he throws in, if indeed we hold firmly to our confidence and the hope in which we glory. Now that hope in which we glory, that hope that we brag about, that means to glory. You know, I glory in my grandkids. I'm proud of my grandkids. They're better than your grandkids. And I didn't mean to say that. I think it. I just didn't mean to say it. No, that's grandparents. That's what means the glory. I said, and this is what we brag about. This is what, you know, this is it for us. In our confidence and the hope that we have in Jesus Christ and who he is. We are proud of him. We brag about him. He's not ashamed of us. He's not embarrassed of us. He's proud of us. He says, now don't, we're not ashamed of him. Don't be ashamed of him. Be proud of him. Paul said in Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Paul says, I'm proud of the gospel. I talk about it all the time. I tell everybody I can about it. It's all I think about. And so he lays that groundwork there, reminding them who we are as the church. Some of you may need to be reminded this morning who you are as a believer. And so you're facing some real trials, some real hardships, some doubts, some struggles. You didn't think it would be this hard. You didn't think this would happen to you. I understand. Don't forget who you are. Here's the warning that came long ago that is relevant as if it came this very morning to us. Warning. And this is the warning. Do not allow hardships, struggles, difficulties, pain. Don't allow sickness, don't allow hardships in life to harden your heart. Don't allow your heart to be hardened because of the difficult things that you have to face. You stay the course. You hold on to the anchor. You are faithful, just as Christ was faithful, that you hold on to that. In essence, is what he's saying to them, that, you know, you can see hardships. You live hardships. Don't let them become bigger and greater or better than Jesus, who you cannot see. Now this is where faith comes in. But faith is exactly what faith is. It is evidence of things that are unseen. Now we're holding on to Christ, no matter how storms come our way. And so he begins to tell them and give them this warning in verse 7. And let me just take you to verse 7 then of Hebrews chapter 3. I'm going to read it. It's not on the screen. But this is what the preacher says. He uses his text. So every preacher has a text. This is his text. Psalm 95. Now they know Psalm 95. Psalm 95 is a common call to worship in Jewish synagogues. They've been hearing it forever in their life as Jews. And it goes like this. The Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of resting in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested and tried me. God said, man, they just are on my last good nerve. Through 40 years, though for 40 years they saw what I did, they still were just obstinate, difficult, unfaithful. This is why I was angry with that generation, God said. I said, their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declare on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. And so it's the concept of rest. In this case, he's going back to the Exodus and the Hebrews. Moses were leading from Egypt to the promised land that got messed up and wandered around. What should have taken less than 40 days took 40 years. And God said, they didn't get to the final destination. They just didn't make it. So that's what he's giving as the background for what is happening there. And so he's telling them, now don't allow the same thing to happen to them to happen to you. Don't let these hardships harden your heart. And this is why I kind of want to do something here in these few minutes we have left, a little different. I'm going to call some from volunteers from the audience. I don't really ever do this, but we're going to try it today. So I want Clint and Shay to come on up here, all right? So give Clint and Shay a big, come on up, give them a nice warning, a nice welcome here, all right? Many of you maybe, don't even know Clint and Shay. They're real faithful at our 11:15, and so they're here this morning at 9. They got travel, so this works great, gives an opportunity to be here. They're brand new members of our church. And so this is Clint, this is Shay. But this morning, as you look at them here, this is Betty, okay? She's Betty. This is Fred, all right? All right, I need another couple this morning. How about Mary? Come on up, Bob and Mary, and that's all right. Come on up. Give him a nice, man, that's kind of a week. Give it all up for him, all right? Welcome on, come on up. And so this is Barry and Bob, longtime members here at Bethany Church, very faithful. But for this morning, this is Amanda. This is Tom, all right? Okay. Now, we haven't rehearsed any of this, have we? You don't, this random call up here, right? Okay. So this is, they're going to help me this morning by just standing there. I want them to be sort of visual representations of what I want to share with you here, which is basically a tale of two couples. If you've been any time around the church, if in any life in the church at all, you'll recognize Fred and Betty and Tom and Amanda. There'll be some other name, but there'll be somebody that you can recall, somebody that you can remember. And so I just want to kind of share the story. It's a common church story of two couples. And so Betty had grown up in a, let's say, a Presbyterian church, but she quit attending when she went to college. Her husband, Fred, had never been involved in church, and the couple stayed busy in the first years of their marriage by building their respective careers and in advertising and accounting. After the birth of their first child, Betty felt the need to get involved in a church and expose her daughter to the things of God. So she visited the community church one Sunday morning, and she was pleasantly surprised by the warmth of the people. So the next evening, she convinced Fred to go to a church dinner they were having. And Fred really enjoyed meeting a lot of people there, and he was a guitar player, and he was impressed by a young man that was playing guitar for their dinner. And so this couple, Fred and Betty, well, they gradually became more and more involved until Betty joined the church, and then Fred's commitment to Christ, came to know Christ and part of the church. Betty did a lot of volunteer service at the church. She worked in when she could in any way around the church, especially in the church office. Fred joined the tech team, the AV team, the worship team, and their kids were involved in the children's programs. Both Fred and Betty were seen as being key leaders in the community church. Now, one of Betty's friends in the coming years was Amanda, a leader in the children's ministry, in the church's women's ministry there. Amanda was quite a leader there, and Amanda became a Christian really at an early age. She had grown up in a loving, faithful home in the South where both her parents were deeply committed to Christ, and she came to know Christ at an early age. She growing up in the church, Amanda was president of their youth group in high school, and she went on mission trips. She was involved for Young People for Christ organization. She went off to college, and she went to a small Christian university near her hometown and became deeply involved with Campus Crusade. Now, while she's at the university, Amanda meets Tom. And Tom was working on his master's degree in business. He was not a Christian, but he was charming. He was handsome. He was intelligent. And really wasn't typecasting, but it kind of worked out that way, didn't it, Bob? It worked out that way. But he did agree to go to church with her from time to time. So against the counsel of her parents, her pastors, some other close friends, Amanda started dating Tom seriously and eventually said yes to his proposal of marriage. After their marriage, the rigors of his graduate program gave Tom less and less time to attend church. So when he had finished grad school, then they moved to further their career. And they moved to the same town where Fred and Betty lived. They moved on the same street. They lived down a few houses on the same street. So they moved to Texas, and they bought a home right down the street from Fred and Betty. And Amanda became involved in the community church almost immediately, but Tom did not. About 2 years later, Betty went through a crisis of faith. When her children were school age, she decided to go back to work part-time at a large accounting firm in the area. She became close to several of the young professional women at the office. Betty was refreshed by their winsome attitude, their zest for life, and then with her heavy responsibilities at church and home, she was feeling a little burned out. Knowing that she should be witnessing to her new friends at work, she felt that she neither had the gifts nor the emotional energy. Her friends' occasional jabs at Christianity stung and motivated her to keep her faith to herself. The women seemed fulfilled, and for the most part, they had pretty good relationships at home. They read all the latest books on parenting and marriage and seemed to be doing quite well with life. They enjoyed themselves. They attended parties together, going on weekend trips with her husband. Her church life began to seem rather dull and boring. Who was she to tell them that they needed to accept Christ to have a full and meaningful life? They seemed to already have a full and meaningful life. She shared her concerns with her husband and Amanda, but it didn't seem to help. And so just before Betty re-entered the workforce, Tom, the husband from whom Amanda had prayed for faithfully for 6 years, had become a believer. Became a believer by playing golf with the pastor for 2 years. And one day on the golf course, Tom saw his need for Jesus. Amanda was ecstatic. He wept, and she wept openly the night that Tom was baptized. In the months to come, Tom devoured the scriptures, became involved with numerous ministry opportunities at the church. He was on fire for the Lord, attending men's meetings and inviting non-Christian friends to worship services. Tom, although busy with his blossoming business, became even more committed to his family, and life was good. Now, down at the other end of the street, Fred and Betty maintained some degree of equilibrium in their marriage, but Betty eventually dropped out of church completely. Nevertheless, Fred stayed the course of church involvement, taking their daughter with him occasionally and continuing with his ministry there at the community church and their worship and tech team. Yet after 2 years, Fred began missing church occasionally and periodically. There'd be weekend trips to see the parents and summer vacation, 2 weeks of illness, during which he stayed home and watched a megachurch service on the internet. These were sort of excused absences. And then they were joined by Sunday mornings that found Fred just tired and just wanting to spend more time with his family. It was much easier to stay at home and watch church on screen in his pajamas. Unfortunately, these became more and more frequent until Fred finally dropped out of church almost completely. Pastor David was heartbroken over this family. He received even a greater shock about a year later. Tom, his most enthusiastic, energetic young convert, whom the pastor had worked, this faithful follower of Christ who had burned a candle at both ends in the Lord's service, renounced his Christian faith. No explanation, no conversation, nothing. He didn't even tell Amanda what had happened to him during this time of his apostasy. He just simply quit confessing, quit coming. He just quit caring. The pastor couldn't believe it. The defections affected him deeply. He cried and prayed and wondered what could he have done for these friends who seemingly had walked closely with Christ. Moreover, he wondered what he could say to do in the future to keep other members from the church from sort of just drifting away, following away. My guess is you can start naming people just like that. Thank you for staying faithful, Amanda. All right. I could always count on you. If you've been in church very long, you can tell that story over and over and over again. Just tell it over and over again. And so the book of Hebrews isn't just important theologically. It raises these important doctrinal questions and issues about a backslidden believer, You know, can a Christian drift away? Can a genuine believer somehow lose their salvation? Are you eternally secure? Do you have any assurance? Were they ever really a Christian to begin with? The truth is, those are hard questions to answer, but they're lived out in reality before us every day, every week, every year. It's you look here and you've sort of wondered what happened to good friends. We probably all had good friends, family members, faithful, committed, volunteers in ministry and service, teachers, workers that sort of drift away from the church. It's just not a problem for the Hebrews. It's a problem for every church we face. Not drifting away. And so, this is what the writer says in Hebrews 3, verse 12. See to it now, brothers and sisters. See to it. He's warning them that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. See to it now, holy brothers and sisters, that none of you lets your heart get hard. Protect your heart, a sinful, unbelieving heart that just sort of turns away, drifts away from the living God. But he says, encourage each other. Encourage one another daily as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. And so that it's a constancy. It's today. Encourage one another. Verse 14, we have come to share in Christ if indeed we hold our original conviction firmly to the end. You know, you can walk around this issue all you want to. Theologically, we'll never really sort of have any total agreement on it, but it's real. It's played every day. Every church, every Christian, every pastor deals with it. And ultimately what he's telling us there is the Exodus is really an example of the Christian life is really the new Exodus. And you had these people who were followers of God going to the promised land, and they didn't get there. They wandered in the wilderness. And what happened is they started out over 400 years ago from when this was written with probably close to 3 million of them. Somewhere between 2 and 3 million of them when they began. Miracles, they were ecstatic. This was the best thing that ever happened. But only two of them over the age of 20 ever made it to the promised land. And so here's the lesson from the Exodus. It's true for the Hebrews. It's true for you and me. It's possible to begin well and to end poorly in the spiritual life. It's not so much about how you begin. You have to begin. It's just how you end, finishing faithfully to the end. And so there's these four points. I'm just going to give you the answers to now. How do you finish faithful? And that's what explained there. You can kind of study these verses 12, 13, and 14. You'll see them there. Well, how do you finish faithful? Well, you learn from others. You learn from the example. He gave them a positive example of faithfulness in Jesus Christ, gave them a negative example of faithfulness in the children of Israel and wandering in the wilderness. Tell me, it's not easy to endure. And then he says, number two, guard against unbelief. You need to protect your heart. And that's what he tells them in verse 12. No, guard your heart and make sure every day you check and guard your heart. Number three, you need to give and receive encouragement. And one thing you do is you gather together, and they were failing to gather together. And he warns them a little later there, you've stopped coming to church. Well, part of it is you miss that encouragement that comes from being together, helping each other. And then he says, hold firmly to your salvation. And you're not saved by holding on to it. But what it says there now, you don't neglect it. You hold on to it. You don't cast it aside. You endure. You don't quit. You don't give up. You hold on to that. And so I share with this story right here. The Christian life is not a dash. It is not a 100-yard dash. The Christian life, when we begin it, is a marathon. It is a marathon. The name marathon, by the way, comes from the Battle of Marathon. It was a great battle between the Greeks and the Persians, and the Greeks defeated the Persians. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't even be hearing about Greeks. And then what happened when they won that great victory? A Greek soldier ran all the way day and night to Athens. And when he got there to the magistrates and the leaders of Athens, he cried out, "Rejoice, rejoice, we have conquered. We have been victorious." And then he dropped dead. He dropped dead. He had completed his mission. He had done well to the end. And so when Paul comes to the end of his life, he has one more thing he wants to say to a young Christian pastor by the name of Timothy. And he says, "Timothy, this is what I want you to know about me." He doesn't say anything about his conversion experience miraculously and how God chose him. He doesn't talk about all those missionary journeys and all those hardships. He doesn't talk about all those churches he planted, all those converts he had. He doesn't talk about the size of the church. He doesn't talk about any of those things. This is what he says to Timothy. "I fought a good fight. I fought the good fight, and I finished. I finished. I kept the faith." And so I want you to pray with me this morning. I don't think there could be any greater thing said about me at the end of my life, and the only legacy I really care two whits about is he finished the fight. He finished the race. He stayed faithful. And that's my hope and prayer. If you haven't begun that race, you can start it today. If you're wavering in that, I'll meet you right down here at the front. Something I can pray with you about. Father, help us, Father, to endure and to be to the end. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.